Сегодня в Москве в подъезде собственного
произошло
дома...
Произошло убито Анна Политковская.
Убийство произошло...
Журналистка «Новой газеты» была убита 7-го.
Дом, которого обвиняют в организации убийства Анны Политковской.
They've been gunned down in stairwells, they've been shot dead on Moscow streets, and one was even poisoned with a rare radioactive isotope in the heart of London. Political assassinations have become a regular feature of post-Soviet Russia, from television anchor Vladislav Listiev back in 1995 to Boris Nemtsov in 2015. And today marks the 10th anniversary of one of the most shocking, the 2006 killing of investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya. What accounts for the proliferation of assassinations over the past two decades? Are they random and isolated acts of violence, or is there a method to the madness? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. It's just you and me today.
Yeah, let's see what we can do.
So today marks the 10th anniversary since Anna Politkovskaya was killed. Next month, we also mark 10 years since Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned with polonium in downtown London. Since that time, just to name a few, there have been the assassinations of lawyer Stanislav Markelov, journalist Anastasia Baburova, human rights activist Natalia Estimirova, and of course, opposition leader and former Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov. And the phenomenon of political assassinations is not unique to the Putin era. During Yeltsin's presidency, journalist Dmitry Holodov, TV presenter Vladislav Listiev, and State Duma deputy Galina Starovoytova were assassinated, just to name a few. Do you see continuity between the Yeltsin and Putin periods, Mark? Or is there something markedly different in what we're seeing now and what we saw in the 90s?
I think there is a continuity, but it's an interesting and depressing shift in so many ways. You've got to realize, in the Yeltsin era, assassination, contract killing, call it what you will, was a very, very frequent phenomenon in the streets, in business and so forth. I mean, in a way, we notice particularly the political, the media-related ones. But actually, you know, this is a time in which gangsters were gunning down gangsters, gangsters were gunning down business people were having other business people gunned down and so forth. And that particularly profligate use of violence as a tool of business did actually decline when Putin came in, because it was this... The sense was that this made it look as if the state did not control the streets, and that's something that Putin was not willing to accept. And we still have contract killings, but... On the whole, they're more limited and they're much more targeted. Instead of being a drive-by shooting or a car bomb, it's just the individual and maybe their bodyguard. So what has actually happened, though, as in so many other ways, what was business practice in the 1990s became adopted in some ways by the state elite in the Putin era. You know, we see this whether it's in terms of their involvement with, you know, raiding of businesses and taking them over, the profligate embezzlement and so forth. The 1990s were in some ways ironically one in which actually the officials were much, much weaker. They took bribes, of course, but they weren't in charge of things. Under Putin, the officials became in charge of the economy, in effect. And I think, therefore, just as they absorbed so many other practices of business 1990s style, I think they also accepted the notion that occasionally killing is also a tool. So it's not that I think there is some kind of grand plan or anything like that, but I just think it has become part of, in some ways, the political culture of Russia, is that killing may be the last option, but it is an option.
But to kill somebody as high profile as Politkovskaya, Nemtsov... or even, for that matter, Markelov, Baburova, Estimirova, how high up does the order have to go there? I mean, Kadyrov is suspected in not all of these, but a number of them. Who has to sign off on that?
See, this is it. I don't think, on the whole, they need to be signed off. I mean, you know, we talked about the Nemtsov killing, for example, where definitely my view is that that came from Kadyrov and it came as an unwelcome surprise for Putin, even though presumably Kadyrov thought that Putin was going to be fine with it.
And it's worth mentioning. Which again, is also Kadyrov widely suspected.
Yeah, exactly. One. I mean, again, you see, I don't think... Let's be honest. Putin usually doesn't need to have people killed. Putin has such an extraordinary wealth of instruments to actually make people's lives horrendous. Why go to the trouble of actually killing them? When we actually have cases like Litvinenko, which case I do believe Putin would have had to sign off on that because that was international and high profile.
British citizen.
Yeah. Well, British citizen, yes, though, as far as the Russians are concerned, one of ours, you know, right. Litvinenko Nash. But beyond that, you know, as it were, for domestic killings, I don't think that necessarily Putin needs to have people killed on the whole. He can have people locked up. In some ways, it's other people who actually need to have these things. And I think it's not so much that it needs to be signed off as that people have to believe, possibly wrongly, but believe that the Kremlin will be okay with it.
Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a minute, because I know the conventional wisdom, as you said, on Nemtsov was that Kadyrov probably did it. He thought it was going to please Putin, but he was wrong. It was a very unpleasant surprise for Putin. You could probably say the same about Politkovsky. Mm-hmm. On Putin's birthday of all days. But isn't this possibly just a form of plausible deniability for Putin? Because when you look back at these things, okay, the Nemtsov assassination caught the Kremlin a month or so of grief, and now they're rid of a troublesome opposition figure. The Politkovskaya case caused them a month or so of grief, and now they're rid of a troublesome investigative journalist that was exposing Kremlin malfeasance as well as human rights abuses in Chechnya. You have to wonder if just if a few of these every now and then, it's almost like a hybrid great terror, so to speak, with the randomness of it. Now, is that too conspiratorial by half to put it out this way, that maybe is Kadyrov Putin's death squad in a sense?
Well, I mean, it's plausible. I'll grant you that. But you know, I hope you realize that was a little morsel of comfort I'm giving you before disagreeing.
Of
with
course,
you.
No. I'm not sure I believe this.
I think again that there is danger of assuming that Putin and Putin's pals and cronies are smarter than they are. But on the other hand, I mean, ultimately we have to think. Well, okay, what was really the benefit? Nemtsov was not a danger. Nemtsov was in some ways, yes, he was non-systemic opposition. He was not going to get anywhere. Nemtsov was not anyone who was going to be a serious threat. Now, I'm not saying that he's been turned into some grand martyr, though there is the constant pressure over naming the bridge and such like. And I think, you know, one has to ask whether or not Nemtsov dead can be at least as much of a rallying cry for opposition as Nemtsov alive. But again, I mean, I really don't think he's someone that you need to be bothered to kill. And especially in a way that did cause huge amounts of embarrassment and it's clear that the Kremlin was deeply discomforted by what happened. Politkovskaya, now, in some ways, Politkovskaya, I would say, was much more of a real inconvenience and threat to the Kremlin. But even then, I mean, you can silence someone all kinds of ways without necessarily putting them in prison and making them sort of symbols. If nothing else, she could have just been basically pushed out of the country. And then she would have been one more person writing quite possibly well-penned polemics against the Kremlin, but without the local knowledge, which was, you know, such a central thing that made her writing so extraordinary.
Now, the counterpoint to that would be that this isn't about Politkovskaya per se. Mm-hmm. And it's not about Nemtsov per se. It's about creating an atmosphere of fear and intimidation. And in this sense, would you say that these assassinations are potentially, and I'm, again, not sure I believe this, because I tend to fall more where you're falling on this, but I just to open it up for discussion a little bit, are these assassinations a little bit useful to the Kremlin in that sense? They make everybody else think twice. Once Nemtsov was killed, now that crossed a line. You weren't supposed to kill a member, an opposition leader. You can imprison them, harass them, but not kill them. A former deputy prime minister, a former member of the elite. A line was crossed there, and now everybody's about to be scratching their head saying nobody's safe, right?
Sure, though at the same time, though, people are thinking, how far is Kadyrov truly under control? I mean, it weakened as well as strengthened. No, I mean, I think if one looks, for example, take Politkovskaya, and generally speaking, it became very dangerous to write about Chechnya. Even if you weren't going to be killed, the chances of being targeted for harassment, beaten up, all kinds of things. And I know from speaking to journalists, there are quite a few who thought, okay, Chechnya's out of bounds.
No, Mikhail Zigar writes about this in his excellent book that I'd recommend to everybody, All the Kremlin's Men. He writes that basically it's understood that you could pretty much write about anything except Chechnya safely. Mm-hmm. This was the feeling in the early 2000s. So, but after Politkovskaya,
Then again, one can point to the fact that there was still excellent investigative journalism. I think it's more, again, I would see this as a symptom more than a strategy. I think this is a symptom of a state in which people who have power believe that they can get away with, and on the whole, unfortunately, rightly, believe that they can get away with using violence. Violence, coercion of all kinds, whether it's in terms of just simply closing down someone's business or harassing someone with a fake tax case, all the way through to sometimes using actual physical violence. And then, obviously, at times, that will bubble up into these particularly egregious cases. But as I said, I think the real fear that people have, and absolutely, I mean, I think this is what we are seeing, and this is one of Putin's depressing triumphs, is actually to create this climate of fear, especially in his most recent term. That was a Freudian slip when I said last. is precisely to create a fear that everyone feels. But I don't think it's because they think they're going to be gunned down in the street. I don't think they believe that. But I think in the end,
you don't think Navalny's thinking about that? You don't think Kasyanov's thinking about that?
I
do.
I mean, I'm sure they're aware of this possibility. But I think, in a way, it's not the Navalny's and Kasyanov's that are the important people for controlling Russia. It's ordinary Russians. It's the people in the ministries, in the factories, in their homes. And I think there we have a very different kind of fear. What do they fear? They fear precisely someone saying, you know, that you've been unpatriotic and so forth. So I would say this is not kind of hybrid purges, but if one really wants to push this parallel, it is a form of hybrid great terror.
Yeah, this is exactly, and this is
but
how
it's,
I
but
dubbed
it's
it.
Based on exactly, but it's based on the dull day to day fears, not these particular handful of high profile ones.
No one asks you to pull kind of some of your expertise in organized crime out of your hat here and talk about how the anatomy of a hit. When the decision is made by whomever to kill a Politkovskaya or a Nemtsov, or a Litvinenko, for that matter. How does the process work? What happens?
Well, I think we have to distinguish, for a start, very sharply between what clearly seem to have been state operations, such as Litvinenko,
mm-hmm.
and what were essentially criminal-style operations, such as the Nemtsov and Politkovskaya killings. Not necessarily that it wasn't
related to the state.
Exactly, but nonetheless, in terms of methodology, basically, Nemtsov was whacked, whereas Litvinenko was assassinated in those cruises. In that sense, well, the depressing truth of the matter is that although one hopes it's morally difficult, in practical terms, it's very easy to kill someone. Mm. You just basically need access to a gun, the person's location, a getaway, and cover. Now, I mean, in a way, if one stops, and a gun means any other, whatever weapon you're going to use. But on the whole, exactly, it's going to be a simple method because simple methods are the easiest to use. It's extraordinarily easy to get weapons. There's a massive black market in arms.
Right.
So even without actually having to just sort of pull one out of your sort of Chechen police office safe, you can get yourself a gun without any trouble. And frankly, gun control, even just tracking the gun back, is actually very difficult in Russia. They don't have good records. So it's a question really of just finding the person, killing them, and getting away. And again, that actually is generally just simply a matter of because, these are people who have, known addresses, whether work or home, known haunts and such, like take Politkovskaya.
She was under surveillance for a while, but this is more complicated than just getting it. She was under surveillance for a while. Mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking about from the moment of the decision point, like somebody decides, I want to have Politkovskaya killed. I want to have Nemtsov killed to stick with the what we're calling the whackings now rather than the Litvinenko. How does that go from point A, from the point of conception to execution?
Well, let's say you're Kadyrov. Congratulations, you've been promoted.
Great.
and you decide that such and such a journalist has to die. What you would generally do is, I mean, maybe you'd actually explicitly say so to a trusted
So, like,
cohort.
Will someone please rid me of this troublesome priest?
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe it'll be a little bit more elliptical. It'll just be something, this is a person who's asking to have bad stuff happen to them. But everyone knows what you mean. There is often this desire. And again, I mean, I'm not sure if so much with Kadyrov, whether he feels he has to. But under other circumstances, people would generally want to try and ensure they have some degree of deniability built into the process at the very top. So your henchman, anyway, one way or the other, whether directly or indirectly, knows what they're meant to be doing. And then you'll go out and you'll basically find someone who will arrange the trigger men. Again, you're looking to create a few layers of detachment, and we've very much seen this with the Nemtsov case,
right?
Where it's clear that the investigation was able to get through a couple of layers,
right?
And that's when
let's say you have the Zakashik, the person that ordered it, the Pastrednik, the middleman, and the Ispolnitel, the shooter. At the end of the day, and it's basically three teams or two teams.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you actually have sort of a couple of middlemen. You know, again, as it goes down the chain of command, you staff it out, and then you'll find the shooter. And on the whole, the shooter doesn't need to be especially talented. It's not that difficult to kill someone. Usually isn't going to be particularly sort of senior or whatever. But you have to actually decide, well, what are you going to offer them? It has to be worth their while. Now, the prospect of people being caught, obviously, no one expects to be caught, but there's always that possibility.
But it's the triggermen that always go down.
The triggermen go down, but they know that. So in some ways, what you're going to be offering them is, as it were, something up front, but also a degree of security, a degree of protection, that you might have to go to prison, but don't worry, we'll look after your family, we'll try and make sure that you get out as quickly as possible, and when you do get out, we will look after you. And the interesting thing is, and in this respect, it's almost like the old culture of the KGB. KGB had this sort of strong culture that we will always get our agents back. Even if it takes years, one way or the other, we're going to get you home. Well, we actually see a sort of faint, similar loyalty coming present in organized crime and these kind of operations. Not because they're nice people, but because they know that that's how you maintain the loyalty. Because at the same time, the trigger man is the person who also has the information that could be embarrassing to you. So you have to give him, and it almost always is a him reason to keep quiet. So there's, as it were, what you offer them up front and the insurance policy when things go wrong. Because, yes, these days, often people do get caught. The Russian state can throw a huge amount of resource into investigations if it wants to.
If it wants to, that's the opportunity. But these things tend not to be solved. They tend to get the trigger man, and that's it.
Sure. And again, I think that's because...
Is there a reason? Yeah. It's
precisely because this is, as I said, a symptom of a wider issue. This is not just that there's a bad guy called Kadyrov. I mean, he is a bad guy and he has gone rogue to an extent. But he's gone rogue within the broad, as it were, sort of etiquette of Russian political life. He's not completely out on a limb. First of all, the people at the top of the system are the dangerous ones. Secondly, sometimes it's useful to have something in your back pocket. If Putin ever wants to get rid of Kadyrov...
He can pull a lot out of his
precisely.
Back pocket.
Yeah. And especially if he pulls something like Nemtsov out, all of a sudden, he's the guy who solved the crime of the terrible death of the opposition figure. It's convenient. But there's also, and it's the same way as we see with senior, major corruption cases. That actually, when really powerful people are caught, on the whole, they don't really go down. It's just embarrassment and whatever. It's because everyone is, on some level, potentially involved. No one really wants to unpick that mess.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's actually precedent for this. If you go back to the Galina Starovoitova assassination, which I covered closely in St. Petersburg in the 90s, everybody and their brother knew that Kumarin was behind that thing. I mean, it was really the openest secret in the world. But Kumarin didn't go down for it until, this century. He didn't go down for it until well into Putin's term. He decided to pull that out of his pocket at that point. No, there's another... You noted that you don't have to be terribly talented to kill somebody, but some of these hits are extremely professional. I mean, what I'm thinking of is the 1997 assassination of Vice Governor Mikhail Manevich in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with that one, he was being driven to work down Nevsky Prospect, the main thoroughfare of the city. Sniper hits him from an attic window. Obviously a sharpshooter, obviously Spetsnaz. Why is that? Why do we have that deployed in some cases, and in other cases, people that are clearly amateurs?
Well, I suppose basically it comes down to the nature of the market and the nature of the target. Especially in the 1990s, but to an extent since, we have had sort of out-of-work people with highly dangerous skills. And on the whole, they were employed by organized crime rather than the others, because organized crime paid better. We had several cases. Again, in the 1990s, Atari Kvantrishvili, Georgian, who was basically well on his way to making himself the godfather of Moscow. And that reached a point where basically many of the other groups said, no, we have to get rid of him. Chechens and Russians alike. They outsourced it to, again, a highly professional sniper, knowing that Kvantrishvili wore a bulletproof vest. He actually shot him through the shoulder. There is some highly technical thing. But again, who do the people who get killed in these technical ways, who are they? The answer is they're well-protected targets. They're mafia godfathers, they're governors or whatever. They're people who actually, just, you know, some guy from the North Caucasus wandering up with a Makarov pistol is not going to get within shooting range
right.
of these people. So obviously at that point you have to turn to the skilled. But the interesting thing is this, it clearly shows that, you know, there is obviously capacity around there in Russia, as obviously in other parts of the world, but particularly in Russia. What there isn't, though, is a sort of murder incorporated. There isn't a kind of specific organized crime grouping that does this. I mean, on the whole, these people are freelancers. And secondly, what's interesting is the state itself doesn't seem to have, its own killing department.
Except for Kadyrov.
Well, but even then, but when Kadyrov kills, it's not, I mean, he's enthusiastic, but one wouldn't necessarily say he's particularly professional. Even when we see Kadyrov's enemies, I mean, and again, we've got to realize that Kadyrov has a long pedigree of killing people out of the country and in the country.
Yes.
And I'm thinking particularly of the Yamadayev brothers. Who were being cultivated
one in the
early
country
days.
And one out of the country.
Exactly. But, you know, they were being cultivated as a potential alternative power structure within Chechnya in the early Kadyrov presidency, closely linked to the GRU military intelligence. And one of the Yamadayevs, the one who was killed in Moscow, I mean, it was literally, you know, he was in a car just outside.
In front of the White House.
In front of the White House. Just someone, you know, walked up to his open car window and shot him through the window. Nothing particularly skillful or whatever. And even if one looks at Litvinenko, I mean, the interesting thing is you have on the one hand an extraordinarily, exquisitely expensive and complex and hard-to-detect radioactive material being used. And the actual presumed assassins being singularly unprofessional and incompetent in how they used it, so much so that they sort of left swaths of radioactivity
all
around.
From the plane to the football stadium.
Precisely. Again, this was not, as in the movies, some, you know, hyper-competent state assassin. And it's not because I think they chose not to use them. I think actually the Russian state has got professional killers in uniform. You know, Spetsnaz, if you want a good sniper, they've got those guys. But an actual professional killer, I think that's something that we see, ironically, they've lost a capacity that the KGB clearly did have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to this Kadyrov thing, because I'm not going to let this go. if he keeps embarrassing them, why? And he's obviously going to do more. I mean, he's not going to stop. And they don't stop him, or Putin doesn't stop him. He's got plenty of enemies within the elite that would love to stop him. The FSB
Absolutely.
Wanted to take him down over Nemtsov, but Putin wouldn't let it happen. What's behind that? If he is so embarrassing to the elite, this is why what keeps giving me pause, mm-hmm. and keeps making me ask the question: is Kadyrov going rogue and Putin's just tolerating it, or is Kadyrov the death squad?
I think Kadyrov is more rogue than death squad because they are terrified of Chechen War 3. They have convinced themselves, in my opinion wrongly, but they don't ask me, that Kadyrov is absolutely essential to keeping Chechnya under control. But more to the point, if they took Kadyrov out, whether you know, by whatever means, that essentially Chechnya would fall apart and they'd be once again having to send troops in. The Chechen War, I mean, on the one hand, it was a great triumph for Putin. You know, he achieved what Yeltsin couldn't and such like. But actually, you know, everyone who was involved knows just how difficult, expensive and dangerous it was and is, and how problematic the Chechens are. If anything, I think they have a magnified sense of just how dangerous the Chechens are. And this is from my conversations with people within the sort of the security realm in Russia. One thing that comes time and time again is however much, it's not even a case of, you know, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard. It's more a case of, but what can we do? We're stuck with Kadyrov. It's Kadyrov or war.
But yet, given that, the FSB wanted to take him out after the Nemtsov assassination.
Yeah.
Or do they want to just knock him down a peg? I mean, what?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think, you know, because in a way, you as it were, you have to start start with saying get rid of him, even if you're just thinking of it as a haggling stage and you're willing to be haggled down to simply being not taken down a peg or two. I don't know. In some ways, again, I think the key distinction is between, as it were, the FSB, the operational level, there where there is a considerable dislike of Kadyrov, and shall I say the political level, including, of certainly Patrushev. I'm not sure about Bortnikov, but as I understand it, certainly Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council, and obviously a very influential figure within Putin's circle, is absolutely determined that we cannot afford, especially now, we cannot afford more trouble in the Caucasus. What's going on in the North Caucasus is bad enough, but it's a low-level insurgency. The Chechens could be something completely different. Mm-hmm. And so I think, Kadyrov knows this. I mean, it was fascinating that last year, earlier, he had this sort of showdown this year with the Kremlin.
Yeah.
He more or less said, maybe it's time for me to go and the Kremlin should just appoint someone else. I mean, that was basically calling the Kremlin's bluff, and the Kremlin folded. And since then, basically, not only is he particularly cock-a-hoop, but also he's had his all-important budgets for Chechnya protected, even at a time when everyone else had to make cuts because of the need to funnel money to Crimea. I think from this point of view, actually, Kadyrov has no reason to stop. He's got away with it all.
I mean, he accounts for, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but if you look at the names and you look who's suspected, for a large proportion of these assassinations. You mentioned the two Yandoyevs, Nemtsov, Politkovskaya. I mean, the others, Markelov, Baburova, Estimirova. The only big assassinations he's not suspected of that I can think of off the top of my head are Baburova and Markelov, who are those were nationalists that allegedly hit them. He's not going to stop, right? We can expect more of this.
We can, subject to two caveats. One is people actually mattering him to him sufficiently that he actually is willing to kill. I mean, the one thing I can't help but notice is these days, on the whole, people aren't taking Kadyrov on, except for someone like Navalny, who presumably is, if nothing else, in a sense of, A, what has he got to lose? B,
his
I'm
life.
Sure, well... Probably Navalny is one of the most carefully watched people outside the government. I don't believe he was. You see, this is it. I mean, I think this notion that Nemtsov was under 24-hour surveillance, I think is absolutely wrong.
Mm.
But whereas Navalny, I think, clearly at the moment is. But also, I mean, again, this is maybe giving Kadyrov too much credit, but I think after Nemtsov... And he got a scare after Nemtsov. Putin, again, going back to
Putin
Zygar's
wasn't taking
book,
his calls for a while.
Exactly. I mean, this all matters. And he was writing these kind of abject Instagram messages. And it quite bizarre when politics is handled through Instagram, about saying how devoted to Putin he was. Well, I think that that was Nemtsov, the embarrassment level, I mean, embarrassment makes it sound rather more, the potential risk to the Kremlin of an assassination of Navalny. I think even Kadyrov must be aware of that. So it's a question of, as it were, a target that Kadyrov thinks is worth hitting. And secondly, look, again, there is this sense of what we don't know, because we don't really know our way into this little black box, is actually whether or not, in a way, Kadyrov now feels confident in the sense of confident that he can do anything anywhere, or confident just simply in the sense of, look, I've now got Chechnya. I mean, essentially what happened when he challenged the Kremlin... The Kremlin admitted, in effect, that Chechnya was an autonomous little statelet that Moscow had to pay for. That's a pretty sweet deal. Why mess with it?
Yeah. No, it's a recipe for more of this stuff. I think. On Navalny, I certainly hope he's well protected, one way or the other. Otherwise, I'm not sure that'll matter. But I think he's got to be thinking about this because he is going after Kadyrov. And he would be I don't think Kadyrov was chastened by the Nemtsov experience. I just don't.
I would love to think so. It's very hard to tell. I mean, if nothing else, Kadyrov's public persona is always the same.
And if you want to talk about somebody who is actually potentially more than Nemtsov, a genuine threat to the Kremlin at some point, it's Navalny.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean...
A genuine threat to the Kremlin.
Yeah, quite. But to that end, I wouldn't be surprised if actually something explicitly had been said. if through various, you know, the people who do connect Zolotov and so forth, who do talk to talk to Ramzan, actually it could well have been said, just do realize though that Navalny is out of bounds until we decide he's
not. Before we move on to the next section, I wanted to kind of return to Politkovskaya since today is the anniversary. And the word watershed is ridiculously overused. I mean, Litvinenko was a watershed. Nemtsov was a watershed. In what way was Politkovskaya, do you see, as a watershed there? I mean, I addressed this in the Morning Vertical today, looking at Politkovskaya and Litvinenko as this period, that autumn of 2006 period, October, November, when this Kremlin started crossing over into the dark side, truly, these two assassinations. How would you look at the Politkovskaya assassination in this context? Was it a watershed?
I think it was, because up to this point, violence was depressingly enough an occupational hazard of the good investigative journalist within Russia. For some, that had actually been a sort of a fatal risk. However, on the whole, the fatalities tend to be much more associated with actually being, looking into local business in the provinces and such like. It was getting in the way of people's money flows. Politkovskaya was clearly political. This was not just simply about who's skimming the municipal budget. And it was also, it said something about the fact that fame is no protection. Again, there had been this sense that actually, if you're a name, if you're well-known, domestically and indeed in the West, that gave you a certain degree of immunity. Politkovskaya's death, I think, absolutely blew that away and made it clear that this was a regime that didn't care. I mean, in a way that we then had reinforced with the Litvinenko killing. It was, in that sense, not that I said, because I don't think that the regime went out to actually kill Politkovskaya, but in terms of its response, the fact that it just more or less said, well, okay, this is killing, we're going to go through the motions, but basically, we know that we're not actually doing this really, and what are you going to do about it? It was that point of challenge.
And in by just going through the motions, isn't that the functional equivalent of doing it? Really?
Well, I mean, morally speaking, that's an interesting philosophical point. I mean, I think there is a difference. I think there is a difference between, as it were, making the best of a particular situation and actually deciding to do it. They're still going to get you into hell, but perhaps in different circles.
on that note, we will shift gears on this very grim topic. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift gears to foreign affairs and look back at the week when Vladimir Putin basically gave the West the finger and what it means going forward. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Москва и Вашингтон больше не союзники.
Поставлен ультиматум сократить войска
НАТО. Никто не против санкций.
Кремль сообщил о приостановке межправительственных...
Далее требование отменить закон Магнитского.
...очевидном резком ухудшении отношений Вашингтона и Москвы.
So Putin basically flipped the bird at the West this week. The Kremlin leader began the week by delivering an ultimatum to the United States. End sanctions, compensate Russia for the damages, and roll back NATO to its 2,000 membership, or Russia will pull out of a 16-year-old disarmament agreement to turn weapons-grade plutonium into fuel. Russia then launched massive civil defense drills involving 200,000 emergency personnel and 40 million civilians after Zvezda TV, which is affiliated with the defense ministry, reported that, quote, schizophrenics from America are sharpening nuclear weapons for Moscow. Moscow also announced that it was deploying surface-to-air missiles to Syria and sent a battleship to the Mediterranean Sea. And then Russia pulled out of yet another nuclear agreement with the United States, this one on energy research. So what's up here, Mark? Have we crossed a Rubicon here? What's going on? Has nothing changed? I mean, it's because my first reaction to this was, this is more of the same. But then the more you look at it, a lot has happened this week.
I mean, in part, it's the particular concatenation of different things. I think what this represents is a very, very clear statement that, as far as Russia is concerned, it is at war. it is at war with the West, and that it's the war, in Russia's eyes, that the West started.
And the West doesn't even really feel like it's at war.
Well, no, exactly. And this is the sort of the problem.
It's a unilateral Cold War, as I called it this week.
Yeah. What do you do when the other person has decided that you want to destroy them?
And you wrote about this a bit in a piece for BNA Intellinews.
Exactly. I think otherwise it just looks like a kind of a random series of sort of flailings. Let's flatten Aleppo with, you know, thermobaric munitions. Let's unilaterally sort of pull out of agreements. Let's generally sort of ramp up our rhetoric. I mean, it sounds and looks terribly petulant, frankly. But I think, you know, the central unifying issue is precisely that, as far as Russia is concerned, it's engaged in a struggle for its own political and cultural survival against a West that is trying to isolate
it. You think it really believes that?
I do. This is for me the really worrying thing. In some ways, I would so much rather think that this was just cynical rhetoric, that they just played this card as a way of mobilizing their own public, a way of alarming the Europeans and so forth. But I think the more we look into it, I think the more clear it is that there is a circle of people, and I really would stress that, a circle of people, Putin and those closest to him, who actually genuinely believe this. And because he lives in this echo chamber in which he's being told what people think he wants to hear and so forth, that it's just simply reinforcing this perspective. Again, let's just take a look at just the two elements. Aleppo, what looks like absolutely needless brutality, is clearly driven, as far as Moscow is concerned, by a sense that the Americans neither could or would actually bring the rebels to any kind of meaningful negotiations in Syria, and therefore they needed to have some big...
That conveniently ignores, even if that were the case, that conveniently ignores that Moscow cannot rein in Assad either.
Well, no, but again, I mean, that's a good objective
Vladimir
answer.
Vladimir Frolov keeps pointing this out in his column.
They're stuck, and in many ways Assad is therefore driving the thing. But nonetheless, having got themselves stuck with Assad, the way in some ways they are stuck now with the rebels in the Donbass, they're looking to try and sort of achieve some kind of a victory, which they think might be able to be leveraged
can get Aleppo, they think they'll
Yeah, have again, I mean, I think they're misguided, but that seems to be their strategic plan there. It has its own brutal logic. And likewise, I mean, in terms of ending the deals with the United States, I think there is that sense that United States has created a variety of deals that actually are for the United States' interest. And what they do is they hem in and they constrain Russia. And Russia's looking for ways of basically trying to gain some kind of traction with America. And one of the things is to more or less say, you are not the boss of us. We can basically do what we want, which means that you're going to have to be nice to us. Now, again, this scares the snot out of me, because I think it's an exceedingly dangerous policy predicated on a completely misunderstood perception of the world on so many different levels. But I do think, and this is why it's so scary, that it is actually a genuine one.
So it's like you're having to deal with an irrational assailant in a lot of ways. I mean, if I read through the lines of what you were saying in your piece today, it's Putin believes his own hype and therefore is very dangerous, so treat him cautiously. That's if I were to sum up your piece and be in the Intellinews, that would basically sum it up. I said it puts the West in a very paradoxical situation, because on one hand, if we respond in kind, I think that's what they want. That elevates this to the Cold War they want, rather than this unilateral imaginary Cold War we're having right now. But if we don't respond in kind, it's almost like they're going to keep provoking until we do.
But the interesting thing is precisely the extent to which the whole information side of the campaign. And let's be honest, I mean, for example, take these nuclear deals. In the grand scheme of things,
they mean nothing. The 2016 agreement's been on ice since 2014.
Precisely. So basically speaking, they are showstoppers. They are worth an item on the news and so forth. But actually, in reality, they mean very little. And in some ways, that is a metaphor for actually how much of this information campaign operates. Russia creates stories and it agitates and it gets us worried about Russian disinformation and so forth. And that in itself becomes a form of power, because precisely we need to feel that we have to somehow respond. It gives Putin importance and influence that actually he should not have. Because in so many ways, I mean, you know, obviously the poor Syrians and the poor Ukrainians are paying for this. But in more broad terms, actually, Putin has very little traction on the rest of the world.
Now, while when they pulled out of that plutonium agreement that was signed by Bill Clinton and Vladimir Putin in 2000, it got a lot of traction in the media, but I didn't see much response from U.S. officials about this. They kind of shrugged. Because, like I said, that agreement's been on ice since 2014.
And also, I mean, it was rather eclipsed. And it was bad timing to have that at the same time as Aleppo. I mean, Aleppo is, after all, the story that really blots out all others.
Now, I'm just thinking of what triggered this now. And the obvious answer is the breakdown of the ceasefire in Syria. I mean, I've always looked at Russia's gambit in Syria, partially at least, as an attempt to get at the same big table with the U.S., to, you know, the Committee to Save the World, as Vladimir Frolov would call it, basically to be on the big stage, solving a global problem. They had that. The ceasefire was signed. The ceasefire was incredibly advantageous to Moscow. Incredibly advantageous. John Kerry was accused of giving away the store in that ceasefire and came under a lot of criticism for it. And what does Russia do? They violate it within days of the thing being signed. What is going on here? If this is a reaction to the breakdown in Syria, who broke things down in Syria?
See, this is it. I don't actually think that Syria has driven this. I think Syria is a symptom rather than anything else. And I think it's actually more a sort of a concatenation of factors that has meant that basically Russia has decided that this is its key window of opportunity to assert itself. There is a belief in Russia that at the moment the United States, after all, you know, the crucial global hegemon, is distracted and actually weak. You have the presidential election cycle getting closer and closer. And you know, consuming more and more attention. Then you'll have a lame duck presidency until late January. And there is this belief that now, again, Moscow is determined or convinced that Hillary Clinton is going to win the election. And therefore, given that they are also determined that Hillary Clinton is going to be a relatively hawkish, anti-Russian, as they would put it, president, in some ways they have until late January to stake out positions, to build themselves into a state where they are as strong as possible, because there is a sense that come end of January, it'll be that much harder. So I think there was a sense of, okay, because the ceasefire, it looks advantageous to Moscow in many ways, because it gives it a certain amount of sort of credit.
Everything they wanted.
Yeah, but it doesn't win them anything. I mean, actually, the ceasefire could last for months and yet ultimately not win them anything except a little respite to basically build up and more or less basically give Assad more money and weapons. It's all very well. But then what happens in January? But this is it. I think what they're trying to do in Syria is precisely
create a fait accompli before January.
Exactly, to have something nailed down in advance. They feel that they haven't got long. And also, you know, campaign seasons don't last through the whole year. And this is one of the reasons why they're putting their advanced surface-to-air missiles in Syria as well. It's not because, obviously, Islamic State has got an air force.
Right.
In part, it's
the United States does.
Exactly. And it has cruise missiles. And again, you know, the Libyan trauma is very, very strong.
This is another thing that comes out in Mikhail Zigar's book, is that the extent to which Libya really was a trauma for Putin.
Yeah, that sense of the Americans just still going in, and if they don't like an authoritarian leader, especially one that's aligned with Moscow, they'll take him out. That's what they're doing. So anyway, the missiles are there to basically, firstly, protect Assad and protect Damascus if need be, but also just simply as a sign, there will be no new Libyas.
And they're also threatening explicitly to shoot down U.S. aircraft. How far can this go?
Well, I mean, again, this is why I regard it as a scary sort of situation. This is it. For once, I'm not channeling my inner optimist. In that geopolitically, I think the problem for me is once command gets put in the field, I'm sure that Moscow is thinking that once we have S-300s in Syria, the Americans won't dare launch an attack. And to be honest, they're probably right. But what happens? What happens if a plane that actually isn't being sort of vectored into Damascus but is heading in a different direction is regarded as a threat? What happens if, although it's unlikely, the Turks once again get a little more aggressive, or even the Saudis or some? I mean, I think it just creates all kind of potentialities. Now, I don't think Moscow wants to see a plane being blown out of the sky. It's blown up quite many enough.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if command is in the field, if actually it's people in Damascus who are making the decision, it becomes much, much more unpredictable.
And we don't know if command is in the field right now, right?
I imagine it is. I mean, yeah. Just in terms of the... I mean, although these are long-range missiles, just the speed of modern warfare is such that you can't guarantee... Let me put it this way. You can't guarantee that you're going to be able to get some kind of a meaningful response out of Moscow. Mm-hmm.
Now, you address in your piece some of the things you would suggest, how you suggest the West handle this.
This is the problem. I mean, and I wish I had a splendid sort of 10-point plan. I think, again, it's really about just finding this balance between the two extremes. On the one hand, absolutely, if we start playing the game Putin style, well, first of all, we legitimize his entire narrative that the West is out to get him and out to get Russia. And things could spiral very dramatically. I mean, there are people who are saying we should be sort of trying to hack into Russian systems and release
Thomas Friedman had a column in the New York Times, but I think he was being a little bit tongue-in-cheek there.
But I've heard that more generally, I would say. I think in that respect, I think Friedman was channeling a vibe rather than just simply sort of coming up with something. But I think these are very dangerous. And again, these actually make Russia much more than it really is as a threat. But conversely, I mean, there is nothing really, I can see nothing that we can do that will convince Putin and those close to Putin that the West isn't out to get him.
The West isn't out to get him, but the West needs to defend itself.
Well, this is it. I mean, I think there are no sort of positive gestures really could be made that would not actually involve sacrifices of our own values, such
or
as saying...
Or security.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we could not say, well, I'll tell you what, you know, have Ukraine then. You know, because that wouldn't be... not only would it be impossible, it also would actually be entirely wrong. So I think we're left in this very unexciting central sort of area of trying to sort of thread between those two extremes. Not rising to provocation, but on the other hand, neither allowing the Russians to actually... make any kind of substantial headway. The fact of the matter is history is not on Putin's side. History is on our side, and economics and demographics and all these grand tectonic forces. In some ways, all we have to do, however unsexy this sounds, exactly, is get through this current crisis. Mm. If nothing else, in a way, the Russians have built themselves up to a pitch that cannot be sustained forever.
So just keep calm and carry on,
as your people would say. As a good Brit, what else could I ultimately say?
I guess on that note, that's a good way to wrap it up for this week. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks, Mark, for a fun and enlightening discussion.
My pleasure.
Nature of the subject matter. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a 2-week hiatus as I will be on the conference circuit in the United States and in Europe. But Mark and I will record a special Power Vertical podcast from the Warsaw Security Forum, where we will both be speaking in 2 weeks' time. So until then, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.